Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, our guest. He's an emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist, stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. So, what wildlife questions do you have? I hope you'll join in the conversation. You could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, or you could call us at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And again, if you've got some wildlife photos, we always love to hear those, or see those as well, and you can send those to ideas@wpr.org. Scott Craven, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, Larry, and hello to all of our listeners out there. It's great to be back. This is a fantastic time of year. The weather's great. The fall colors are terrific. It's harvest season. There's a tremendous amount of wildlife activity. I keep thinking at these two-month intervals that sooner or later I'm going to get a chance to see, I'm glad COVID's behind us, but not this time. Anyway, on the subject of the harvest season, that's really a big deal right now because the weather for harvest is terrific, and all of the various agricultural commodities are coming in way ahead of last year. I've heard as much as a month or 5 weeks, and that has a lot of implications for both hunting and for visibility of wildlife for just people traveling around the state. So yeah, it's a great time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about the hunting season. What's open and, you know, what's about to start and so forth?
Well, we're just entering the peak of everything. Deer, of course, have been open for a couple of weeks, the archery season. Bear season's been open. Waterfowl just opened last weekend. Big openers coming up a week from Saturday with the pheasant opener and some other small game activities. The big event, the deer gun season, is still about a month and a half away after the election, fortunately. So that's yet another reason why I'm looking forward to the deer season. And, of course, there are many things associated with the deer gun season. There are lots of CWD test sites available this year that hunters should be aware of. They can find those on the DNR website. Another big change is the DNR has just rolled out their new Wisconsin Hunting Regulations pamphlet. Now, there have always been pamphlets, but they've been specific to individual species. They've consolidated that now. So there's one very nicely produced 8.5 by 11 hunting regulations pamphlet that covers all of the species that were previously covered individually. So there's a section on deer, elk, small game and upland birds, bears, migratory birds, and it leads right off with the page that used to be a separate handout, still is, but lists all the season dates. That's handy for people. And maybe what I thought was most useful is right on the inside cover, there's a what's new section that goes through, I think there are 5 changes that are highlighted that hunters really need to be aware of. And here in southern Wisconsin, one big one that I actually hadn't heard about was that pheasant hunting for the first few weeks of the season, which on public hunting grounds usually closed at 2 p.m., has actually, that closure has been moved up to 12 noon. Presumably to give the DNR folks a kind of an open afternoon to get some birds stocked out there during the high demand period. So I think that's a good thing, but I was unaware of that change. I assume it will be posted at the public hunting grounds. But those are the kinds of things that hunters have a responsibility to learn about and adhere to. So yeah, those are some of the things going on. Up north, the grouse and woodcock seasons are in full swing. Leaves are coming down very quickly. They've had a couple cold fronts, and some woodcock have moved in. And we don't know much about the grouse population because the surveys were not, the regular drumming surveys were not conducted last spring because of COVID, but there'll be anecdotal reports trickling in here before long.
Yeah, so, anything else relating to COVID that might affect hunting that you can think of?
Well, there's been a tremendous, it's part hunting and part just general firearms, but the rush on purchasing firearms during this COVID epidemic has been unprecedented. So many more applications for firearms ownerships being processed by the federal government. Ammunition supplies, which again is partially hunting related, but partially other things. Ammunition, especially centerfire rifle ammunition, is in mighty short supply. I'm headed for Wyoming soon for an antelope hunt, and I'm having a tough time finding any ammunition at all in the calibers of the two rifles that I was going to take. I have some, but it's just the shelves. If you go into a large retailer or hardware store or whatever, shelves that used to be stacked with ammunition are virtually empty in many places. And also, I think there's going to be an extension of the kind of pressure that we've seen on fishing resources, fishing opportunities, our national parks, state parks, other outdoor activities. I think that's going to extend into hunting pressure as well. I suspect there'll be more hunters afield. Some will have more time. Some people are still out of work on top of everything else. So my speculation is that things like the public hunting grounds that are stocked with pheasants or some of our waterfowl marshes and so forth will see some increased use, and hunters need to take that into account and be ready to cope with it.
You know, I was looking at the latest DNR magazine, and they had an article on women who hunt. And in fact, we talked about it on the show last week, and one of the women said that her husband was colorblind and she wasn't. And so she helped in a blood trail. And I wonder if you had any thoughts on colorblindness and deer hunting.
Well, that very topic came home to roost in a very, very near and dear way last weekend when my eldest grandson shot a deer with his crossbow, and made what appeared to be an excellent shot. But of course, with archery equipment of any type, the deer usually runaways. And in any event, fortunately, he and his dad had some daylight, and they came down from the stand and were looking at where the deer had been standing and which way it went. And my son-in-law commented on it was a very distinct blood trail. I mean, the deer had been hit hard, and he didn't expect it to go very far before it expired. So there was a very obvious, to anyone who has normal color vision, a very obvious blood trail, and it would have been a fairly simple matter to move directly to the deer. But when he asked my grandson about it, he said, I can't see anything. I can't see any blood. And he was flabbergasted by that observation. And anyway, I did a little digging into it, and it turns out that depending on what reference you want to use, something like one out of every 8 to 12 American males has some degree of colorblindness. So if you want to take 10 as an average, so 1 in 10 or 10%, 600,000 hunters, the majority of which are still male, you're talking about it, you know, in the neighborhood of 50,000 or more individuals hunting who are colorblind and therefore have a difficult time with blood trailing. And online, I did a little work on some chat groups and so forth, and this is a big topic. And hunters talk about various types of lights and filters and so forth that are billed as being helpful in that regard. But most of them have gravitated, like the woman you mentioned, to hunting with a partner who has normal color vision or is a particularly good tracker or whatever, and get around it that way. But I've also located a number of different products in the form of glasses, one large company in particular that advertises that their glasses will restore normal color vision, and we're looking into that for the grandson. I can't say how it's going to work yet, but if it does work, we'll talk about it more on a future program. But it was a surprisingly widespread problem that I think people with normal vision wouldn't even think about.
Yeah, wouldn't even think about it. A listener in the North Woods couldn't stay online. She wanted to express the importance of protecting wildlife by not feeding them. She says it's harmful and can kill animals.
Well, that's certainly true, Larry. There's been a longstanding give and take in Wisconsin, particularly over deer feeding, and that opens up all sorts of problems, attracting deer across busy roads, messing up their gut fauna in terms of digestion, and taking them away from natural food sources and concentrating the deer, which further spreads disease like CWD. So there are all sorts of implications, but it does persist, and I think it's a challenge in terms of attempting to educate the public to this point, because some forms of feeding wildlife like bird feeding are incredibly popular and widely promoted. And it's really when you step over from birds into the world of mammals that you're better off to not get mammals, whether it's squirrels, raccoons, possums, and things like that, all the way up to deer, and certainly bears, to not get them used to human handouts for a whole variety of reasons that are good for us and good for them. So the caller was absolutely right.
All right. Rick in Holman, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Rick.
Well, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I got a quick question for you is on fox and wolves. I'm being overrun by them out in the country. Is there a red fox season? And what can I do about the wolves? They're all DNR tagged.
Well, Rick, that's a reasonably complicated question. I'm not sure what I'm inclined to ask you what problems the fox would be causing. They're a very pretty animal and generally stay to themselves in terms of their dining habits. They're not something that's considered detrimental to some beneficial wildlife species. One of the things that I guess it's worth bringing up is where wolves are quite common, coyotes generally are not. And where coyotes are common, foxes generally are not. So if you go by association where the wolves have displaced the coyotes, foxes have a bit of an opportunity to thrive, and that may be partly responsible for what you're seeing. But in terms of the wolf situation, you say they're tagged by the DNR. You must be able to see some radio collars or whatnot on those animals. The DNR is always interested in monitoring where wolves are and what they're up to. If they're causing problems for you, say with livestock or pets or something like that, then you can deal with both the DNR and with, at least for advice, with USDA Wildlife Services, primarily out of their Rhinelander office, and get some advice and potentially some equipment that can be used to deter the animals if it's a livestock or pet issue. Beyond that, attempting to get these animals reduced or driven out of the area, that's not going to happen. Although this leads into something we'll probably talk more about later, in that delisting of wolves in this area by the federal government, in other words, removing them from the endangered species list, which has happened before but is apparently imminent, is likely to happen fairly soon. And that then puts the wolf management back in the hands of the DNR, which means eventually there could be a hunting season reinstated, as there was for a three-year period a few years ago when they were delisted. If that happens, then you have some options, some more options available in terms of hunters who draw permits, hunting in that area, or doing other things. It changes the game a little bit. So you should stand by to see how that plays out. But in the meantime, if you've got problems, then I would certainly call your local DNR office and or the Wildlife Services people and see what they recommend or can do for you.
There you go, Rick. Thank you so much for calling. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jane Rotunda, our producer. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, emeritus UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining in. Questions or comments or maybe a wildlife experience to share, give a call. 800-642-1234 Or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Paul emailed a photo of a red bat. He noticed it on a thistle plant at while walking from Dane County Park. Kind of a nice photo there, Scott.
Yeah, I don't have access to the computer right now, Larry, but I'll
take a look.
Well, wait a second. Hold it. Yes, I have the bat photo on my phone. That is a really nice picture.
Yeah, it's a great photo.
Yeah. And it's a nice green burdock too. So it was, I don't know when, he doesn't say when this was taken, but it was, pretty neat photograph. Red bats are, in terms of rural areas, probably our most common species, whereby in urban areas, little browns kind of take over that particular position. But these guys, the red bats, are migratory. They're generally solitary. They're very pretty colored, and they're kind of unique among our bats in that they have multiple young in a litter, so to speak, where a lot of the other species just have a single young. So they're one of the tree bats, and it's a neat photograph.
Yeah, thanks for sending that. Chris and Racine, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about, you know, you sound so excited about all the hunting, and that does sound great, but it sounds like hundreds of thousands of people will be out there harvesting animals. What is known about the amount of animals that we actually have, and how do you keep the population safe to make sure that there's enough to reproduce so that we're not wiping them out?
All
well,
right.
That's a great question, Chris, and I would just say that all of our game species are very tightly regulated. The populations are monitored to the extent that they can be. So we have a pretty good idea at any given time what the deer herd looks like, how rough grouse are doing, how many pheasants the DNR puts out, and what the population status is. And as a result, harvest regulations are tuned to those population estimates. For example, with deer, the number of bonus permits or additional permits that are made available to hunters is based on the status of the population in a given county and what direction the folks in charge of that county would like to see the population go. In other words, if it's deemed to be too high, more tags are issued, presumably that reduces it. Or conversely, if they want it increased, they tighten up on the tags a little bit. So there's a system in place to make sure that our game species are protected. Another thing you need to realize, Chris, is that most game species are game species because they have population dynamics behavior that makes them very resilient. In other words, they have a lot of young. They may have multiple broods. I mean, for example, mourning doves have multiple broods throughout the course of the summer. So that they're prolific, and their population dynamics allows them to sustain harvest without negative impacts on the population. Now, that sounds counterintuitive. Obviously, the animals that are harvested are killed and removed, but there's enough left behind so that with annual reproduction, when the hunting season rolls around next year, there'll be just as many as there were before, or potentially more. And a final consideration that I'd bring up is that a lot of our game species, Canada geese, white-tailed deer, and a few others are at or near all-time population levels in many parts of the country. So even in the face of hunting, some of these populations, again, because of their population behavior and available habitat and so forth, are doing very, very well. Now, that's not universal. There are certainly some game species in parts of the country, sage grouse out west and quail in the south, where population declines are being detected, but regulations are adjusted to make sure that the impacts of that hunting pressure are minimized. So I hope that answers your question. Bottom line is, most of the animals that we're hunting here in Wisconsin, despite the fact that many are harvested and end up on our dining room tables during the course of the winter, come next year, there'll be just as many as there were this year.
So. Yes, thank you. Yeah, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jerry in Wisconsin Dells, it's your turn. Hi, Jerry.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. Say, Larry, I'd like to share with your listeners where they can see moose and elk on a regular basis in West Central Wisconsin. But first, I'd like to know from Scott if it's legal for folks to hunt elk and moose in Wisconsin, because if it is, I hate to give out the information.
Well, there is an elk season based on the success of the elk restoration that started back in 1995. But that's extremely limited. We're only talking about, I think, 10 permits. Half of those are relegated to the tribes in northern Wisconsin, and I think five, one going by lottery and four chosen by the DNR, are given out to elk hunters. So it's a very, very limited harvest. So I doubt that your disclosure would have much impact. That hunt, that season is yet to come up. But moose are fully protected and are quite an oddity in Wisconsin. In fact, one of the neighbors, we were up at our cabin week before last, he said, "Have you seen the moose up on 182? And I said, "No, but I'm going to rush up there and try and see it." Well, I didn't, but they occasionally move through the state. There are probably a few that are resident, but moose are a real oddity, even compared to elk. So, Jerry, I think you're free to spill your guts here and tell us where those guys are.
Okay, and I'd like to recommend to your listeners to get a pencil and paper out. We're talking about between Black River Falls and Warrens, the cranberry capital of the world. If you go north out of Warrens on County Highway O, about halfway, maybe 7 miles to Millston, on County O, between Potter Road on the east and Whitney Road on the west, on the north side of O, I started seeing moose in April, and then three more times in the spring, and then nothing all summer. And in the last month, I've seen moose and now elk on three separate occasions, 2 hours roughly before sunset, up to sunset, on the north side of that road below a bluff on a plateau where they graze almost every day. Excuse me, every day, and it has become so well known in that area that there will likely be traffic parked on both shoulders in about a half-mile section of County O with people out of the cars with binoculars. I have now seen moose and elk in person 7 times in the last 6 months on that piece of land.
Wow.
Well, Jerry, that's about as specific as you could get, short of saying, "Listen, I'll be there at 5 o'clock waving a red flag." So I think people will be very interested in that. And obviously a lot of people already are. So I doubt very much that you are the only person talking about this. The crowd will probably only grow. So thanks very much for the information. I hope a few people get a chance to see them.
Thank you, Jerry. Appreciate it. Well, Mike in Oconomowoc, it's your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Scott and Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Had a question about ticks. I've recently moved back to the area, and I just noticed that, you know, growing up, we never really saw ticks until we got up to our cabin in Iola. But now I'm starting to see ticks pretty common and often down in, you know, southeastern Wisconsin where I'm at. And I'm just wondering, are the ticks moving specifically with the herds because they're doing a lot of migration through the area and the weather's not as, we're not having these super harsh winters, or is the tick kind of species, is it growing a lot more in southeastern Wisconsin than it has over the past few years?
Well, Larry, I'm going to ask you about this in a minute, because I'm guessing you've probably had other guests talking about this, but the reality is that deer ticks, which are the ones we're worried about because of Lyme disease, and wood ticks, which have been around since time immemorial, are both pretty darn abundant, and they've been abundant here in southern Wisconsin, where I hunt and spend time outdoors in Iowa County. Fortunately, I've not seen too many around my property, but we had our very light-colored yellow lab out at the cabin in Price County last weekend, and it didn't take much of a run in the woods before she was festooned with them. So they're out there, and if what I'm seeing for ladybug activity and box elder bugs and assorted other things in this warm spell we're having, I'm guessing the ticks are going to be thick while I'm in the woods this afternoon, so I'm preparing for that. So, Mikey, I mean, the fact of life is there are a lot of ticks around here, and when we have mild or warm conditions like this, they're very active, and it'll take some pretty ugly winter weather to put them down. So that's about Larry. Have you heard anything more recently about the tick populations?
No, I haven't, but P.J. Leash from our entomology department will be a guest coming up on the show. I'm not sure the date of that. I can go into more detail, but I'm telling you, no matter where you are in the state, you're going to find ticks in certain areas, and it behooves you to be prepared for it, for sure. But we'll check on that the next time he's on, which should be pretty soon, actually. Maybe Jane Rotunda can tell me when that's going to happen. We'll look into it, though. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. John in Chippewa Falls, what's on your mind?
Hello. I'm wondering about the deer season's been really liberalized lately in Wisconsin. Crossbows, I mean, whoever asked for that for everybody. I'm a muzzleloader. I would be interested in an early season muzzle loader, you know, before deer gun, rather than the week after. Any chance of that happening ever?
The idea of an early muzzle loader season, it's not an idea I've heard put forward, but I would say, because we don't hear anything about it, it's highly unlikely. I think it's still the Wisconsin Orange Army, the gun deer hunters, there's still a lot of them. And certainly there's a lot of crossover between somebody who hunts with a rifle and a bow and a muzzle loader. And some people hunt with all those tools. But I think the gun hunters, including myself, would certainly not be happy about an early muzzle loader season before the deer have a chance to settle down a bit before the gun season. And that's our primary harvest tool to keep the herd in check as well, remains the gun season. And anything that might further compromise the ability to get a good solid harvest out of that, I don't think would be looked on very favorably. But yep. That's just my opinion.
Thanks, John. Appreciate it. Janet in Marquette County, your turn. Hi, Janet.
Hi. My question is, we live in Marquette County, and we have an abundance of deer. We plant 50 acres of soybeans this spring, and we can watch right over the hill. There are 28 deer come down the hill. Some are just beautiful, with big old horns and everything, but they totally ate up 50 acres of soybeans. That is a lot. We call the county. We call the DNR, and their answer is, well, you know, up north, they just eat everything. So it's like they don't want to help us at all. We have too many deer.
Well, Janet, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm inclined to say I'll be there on Saturday with my bow, but the reality of the situation is I'm surprised that you can characterize your answer that you got from both the county. I'm wondering who you talked to at the county level. Each county now has what's called a CDAC committee, Citizens Deer Advisory Committee. And they have representatives from a variety of different, the committee is made up of representatives of a variety of different interest groups, one of which is agriculture. You can go to the DNR website and look under Marquette County and find out who the members of your CDAC committee are, and their contact information will be there. And you can contact the ag rep or the committee chair and express your concerns. And that's how, as I mentioned earlier when we were talking about when the woman was concerned about how many deer might be taken, that's where permit levels are set, and they need, the CDACs need to hear the feedback from people who are either overrun with deer or want more deer, less deer, or the same amount of deer. That's how the decisions are made. So you should voice your concern to that committee, and I would think that so in the, among these soybeans, Janet, do you have additional land beyond what is in production for soybeans?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They know what to choose. Then when the raspberries are ripe, they come and eat the raspberries.
Not my point. My point is, do you have associated woodlands or deer habitat that you have some control?
200 acres.
Okay. Well, and do you have hunters on your property?
Yes.
A lot of hunters?
Three.
Not enough. you know, I understand this is a complex situation, and hunters, you know, hunters are hunters, and they often have their own vested interest, and finding a property where there are a lot of deer, and as you describe it, some with great big horns, that's the kind of thing that will attract hunters. And what, not all of them, but what some of them are after is only that animal with the great big antlers. And what you really need to be doing is thinning out the herd, and that's done by harvesting antlerless deer. So here's what I would recommend. First thing you need to do is talk to your CDAC people. Second thing you need to do, are these family members, the hunters, or just people you let on?
People I let on.
Okay, well, so I would have a heart-to-heart with them. I assume you know them. They've probably been coming for years. Deer hunters are very traditional. Have a heart-to-heart and say, hey, look, you know, we're happy to let you hunt here, but they have, like anybody else, access to, in some cases, large numbers of antlerless permits. And if it were my land, I would go to the hunters and say, hey, here's the deal, guys, or gals, or whatever. You can continue to hunt here, but I want you to each harvest one or two or more antlerless deer for every buck that you take. And that's the incentive for continuing to have permission to hunt here. And I'm sure that if they may not be too happy about that, but you're not too happy about having all those soybeans consumed. So it's your land. It's a privilege that you can grant, and you can put whatever attach whatever conditions you like to that harvest. And I can guarantee that you would find people who would, if these folks, you know, they may be old family friends, I don't know. This is for you something you'll have to work out. But I'm sure there are other groups of hunters who would readily accept your conditions and show up with even a few more hunters, as many as, you know, 100 acres of woods probably wouldn't be safe to have more than five hunters. But that would allow you to start getting this herd down to a manageable level so that you can still see a few deer around to enjoy, but you don't need to see a marauding herd coming out of the woods to consume your crops. And the way to thin them out is to be proactive in terms of having your hunters take more deer. And also, if you're on good terms with your neighbors, talking to them about their deer harvest strategies as well. So that's the, you know, that's the long and short of it, Janet. But you have more power in this situation than you may think you do. You're not helpless to stand by and watch those deer eating up everything you plant. There are some things you can do.
Good luck, Janet. Thank you so much for calling.
One more, Janet, if you're still on there. I mean, Larry, I guess my email address is probably available. But if you talk to the producer, Janet, feel free to email me, and I can go over some of these options that you have for increasing the deer harvest. If you want to, feel free to contact me. Okay?
All right.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Janet. Appreciate the call. Well, Steve in Rome, Wisconsin, your turn now. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi, guys. I have several in-laws who hunt as a regular activity. I'm not a hunter, but they consume the meat of deer, and I'm worried about that CWD and what that might be doing to them. Now, again, I'm not a hunter, so maybe people are laughing. Oh, what's he worried about that for? But I wonder if you guys could straighten me out on that thing.
Well, the long and short of it, Steve, is pretty straightforward. The health organizations do not recommend that any human consume meat from a CWD-positive deer because, as you probably do know, this is related to mad cow disease in terms of the type of disease it is and how it functions. And there's no evidence to this point that it infects or can be passed on to humans. But on the other hand, there's no absolute proof that it can't. So the recommendation is, if the deer is positive, don't eat it. Since CWD was discovered in 2002, 6 miles from the farm that I've hunted on since 1972, every deer that my family and I have taken in the last 18 years has been tested. And 5 of them tested positive, and they were disposed of, not consumed. So that's the way we handle it. And the DNR and their various support groups among sports persons, clubs and whatnot, and civic organizations have made sure that there are a lot of test sites, kiosks, where you can submit the head, have it tested, get the results back before you consume the meat. A lot of people do that. A whole lot of people do not. But if you're in an area where CWD has been found, I just think it's a good common sense to do it. But having said that, you start roaming around the state now, it's good common sense to be wearing a mask too. And I see a whole lot of people who aren't doing it, just like there are a whole lot of people who will eat untested deer. That's a personal decision, unfortunately.
Thanks very much for calling, Steve. Appreciate it. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. He's an emeritus professor from the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. So great to have him along. Questions? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Scott, we're getting quite a few photos from folks. A listener in Rhinelander emailed in a photo of a leucistic turkey. Any comments on that?
Well, I'm just trying to open this up here. Let's see. We've got, there's the turkey. Let's see. Where is it? Oh, yes. Well, not a whole lot to say, except that appears to be what it is. It's a color phase issue, not to be confused with albinism. It's a different situation. But leucism is well, not hugely common, but known in a wide variety of species, including turkeys quite often. I can't, on my phone, the picture's a little fuzzy, but I can't, well, now I've lost the thing. Just a second here. Yeah, I'm having trouble enlarging it very much, but it's actually kind of a pretty turkey, Larry.
Yeah, it is indeed. And those are, during the season, a leucistic tom, for example, would be a turkey that you could harvest?
Absolutely, and the season is open right now, and all turkeys are fair game in the fall. So
yeah,
regardless of tom, hen, or whatever, it would be legal to take that bird, although I think with leucistic animals or albinos, you know, like the white deer up around Boulder Junction and so forth, there's in some cases local, there's certainly peer pressure to maybe leave those guys alone. But
yeah,
that's, again, a matter of personal preference.
Chris in Viroqua will give you a chance. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I'm having an issue with moles. They're digging up my garden, which is all harvested now, but they're also digging into my flower beds. And I've tried the Sonic repellers that go into the ground. They're battery operated. and they're just not working. They're digging within 5 feet of where these repellers are with brand new batteries. And so I wonder if you have any suggestions for me.
Yes, I do, Chris. As a matter of fact, I'm chuckling to myself because I love mole problems. They're very challenging to deal with, very widespread, and often lead to frustration because some of the things, like you just described with the sonic repellents, don't provide very satisfactory results. So here's the situation. Here we are in October, and it's creeping up on the middle of the, here we are in Wisconsin, and it's creeping up on the middle of October. The ground is going to be getting cold and freezing within a few weeks. Personally, I think you should relax, let the moles do what they want to do for a couple of weeks, and they will be gone. They go down deep in the soil layer to stay below the frost line. And depending on the soil moisture in any given year, and we've had quite a bit of soil moisture this year, the moles may or may not spend a lot of time at the surface. Bottom line, leave them. Don't frustrate yourself by trying to deal with them right now. Let the ground freeze and see what spring brings. When spring brings your attempt to get your garden back in and replant your flower bed, then think about an application of several different chemical applications. One is called Mole Med. There are a number of others. They're castor oil based mole repellents, which do seem to provide protection for a period of a few weeks to a month or two, and you just follow the label instructions. But it's also hard to beat a good mole trap, either the harpoon type or the scissors type. Some people have also called the program in the past saying they've had good luck excavating a surface feeding tunnel, which is all those surface ridges are, excavating that carefully, inverting a wash tub or dark box over it, and just putting a rat trap baited with a piece of bacon or something in the excavated tunnel and catching the animals that way. But trapping and some of the chemical repellents do have reasonably good success if you need to deal with it at all next spring. Fair enough?
All right. There we go, Chris. And you know, one mole can make it seem like there's 20 out there. So
yeah,
there usually aren't that many.
That's the other thing. I think the statistics I used to use when I was doing classes on this was that an individual mole could dig about 150 feet of those raised ridges that you see in a night of activity. So you look out and see all this stuff, and oh my gosh, there's hundreds of them, when in fact there's probably only a couple. And therefore, when you catch one in a trap, it's a big deal because you've really taken a big dent out of the limited population. So
there you go,
Chris.
Diana's got a in Madison has another solution. Let's go there. Hi, Diana.
Hi. Well, we used to have a mole problem in our yard, and we had two big dogs, a husky and a malamute. And I just started thinking about, you know, nature and predators and whatnot. And I was cleaning up after the dogs one day, and I just thought, well, you know, they might not like the smell of dogs down in their little trails. So I started just stuffing the dog poop down their holes. And after a while, they went away. They did not like that.
Okay.
Well, I guess if somebody started filling my car with dog poop, I'd probably abandon it too. Well, interesting idea. Moles are somewhat difficult to predict in their activity, and as I said, it's dictated by soil moisture and food supply and whatnot, and maybe by dog poop. But I'm hesitant to recommend that. But hey. The listeners all heard it. If you want to try it, or Chris, if you're still listening and you want to give it a try, feel free. Thank you.
Thanks, Diana. Roger in Spooner, we're on to you now. Hi, Roger.
Hey, thank you very much for taking my call. Just a quick comment. The upcoming weekend is the annual youth hunt for us here in Wisconsin, and I'll be in the deer stand with my grandson. My concern and my comment is, I sure don't see much or hear much about any of the youth hunt on the radio or in the newspaper or anywhere as far as advertising to the general public that is coming up and there's going to be lead flying around the North Woods here near Spooner and probably the rest of the state. And I have witnessed and observed more ATVs and UTVs in the woods than I ever have. And I think it's maybe it should be an effort to educate and inform people that that weekend is coming in about 72 hours. So just a comment. I think we need to do a better job of letting folks know that's coming quickly, folks. And you may not want to, or at least wear blaze orange on your ATV or whatever. My comment. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for calling. Comment, Scott?
Well, Roger's right. The youth deer hunt is coming up this weekend. It's going to be a very warm weekend, so that sometimes makes deer hunting a bit nice, but a bit challenging. But there will be lots of kids out there. They do have to be with a parent or adult, and so that it's pretty tightly regulated. I think in most cases, they're hunting from stands, you know, things like tree stands, muddy blinds, and so forth, and shooting down, which is the safest way to do that. But, I mean, Roger's absolutely right. There will be quite a few kids out there, and deer will be shot at, so there will be bullets flying. Although, as I mentioned earlier, with the uptick in gun and ammunition sales, I'm afraid there are a lot of bullets flying around regardless. But the youth hunts have taken place now for quite a few years. They're obviously popular with the participants, and knock on wood, they've been very safe and go by without a great deal of attention. But certainly people who are out doing other forms of recreation, and on a weekend when it's going to be in the mid-70s, there will be lots of people out, realize that if you're in a wooded area, a place where people might be hunting deer, that you may encounter them. So it's a good idea, I guess, to put the word out.
Bob in Loretta emailed. He sees a lot of birds around his house, juncos, sparrows, some warblers that have been flying in pairs, like spring courtship. And any wonders, any idea why that happens?
You know, some birds stay together for quite a while. Some of the birds I mentioned earlier, like mourning doves that reproduce almost throughout the warm season, do stay together for that purpose. Some of it may be just an anomaly of the way they're being viewed, but I would say that in bird activity has just been incredibly good this year. Now, part of that's a function of a lot of people being home more than they usually are. I know that's my case, but we've just enjoyed watching the birds tremendously this year. And, you know, I've gotten a lot out of things like feeding peanuts to the blue jays and that kind of thing. In that case, it's a family group coming in with other birds that have now left. The red-winged blackbirds, the rose-breasted grosbeaks, you know, they were coming in pairs and family groups, but I don't think that most of these birds, with the reproductive season over, are paying much attention to pair bonds now. Some are, but not all.
Yeah. Richard emailed. He read recently that because of coronavirus, pheasant stocking will be reduced this fall on public hunting grounds. Is that true? Do you know?
Yes, unfortunately it is, unfortunately from the standpoint of pheasant hunters, but because COVID put a real crimp in activities at the state game farm in Poinette, they cut back production from what had been about 75,000 birds that would be stocked on public hunting grounds in the last few years. It was cut back to 50,000, quite a significant reduction. So there'll be where there would have been three birds stocked last year, there'll only be two this year. And those will be, I don't know that a plan's been formulated as to what areas are going to get how many birds or whether every area will just get fewer birds. I don't know about that. But yes, Richard's correct. There will be one third less birds than there were last year of the stocked birds. There are still other birds put out there by conservation groups and native birds, but of the stock birds, there is a big decline.
Another listener called in, couldn't stay online, but wanted to ask about the color blindness. Back to that for a minute, whether folks can see the blaze orange. If not, in what ways can they stay safe?
Well, that's a good question. I assume that they still see a color, but it's muted. And I think what we need to do is with a number of hundreds of thousands of colorblind individuals in the population, surely some of our listeners fit into that category and could give us firsthand account here over the next half hour as to what they see. But I think they just see it a little duller. When I looked into it, I saw one illustration of a huge pile of beautiful fruits and vegetables, which on the left side of the image were what I see with full color vision, the red tomatoes and the yeah. you know, and so forth. Whereas on the other side, it was all a very much muted tones of green and yellow and that kind of thing. So, I mean, if you have full color vision, you can't really appreciate this. So hopefully a caller can call in and enlighten us.
Yeah, that'd be great. Scott Craven, our guest today, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He will be with us right up until 12:30 today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back. You stay with us. I'm Larry Mehler for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of wildlife on the show today, Larry Mehler here with my guest, Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. He stops by every other month to talk about the great outdoors. So, what wildlife questions do you have? I hope you'll join in the conversation. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. And, Scott, we're getting some responses relating to color blindness. Lee and Tracy both are with us. Let's go to Lee first in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Lee.
Hello, Larry. Love your show. Listen to it every day.
Thank you.
I was born on a farm in the Shawangan National Forest, and we hunted everything, deer, bear, you know, but by the time that I was about 8 or 9 years old, my father realized that I was colorblind. And it's not so much a fact that it's a mutation of color. I can see in temperatures, but during deer season, when the leaves are turning, I can't tell blaze orange from anything else. So I had to quit deer hunting, unfortunately.
Okay. I'm sorry to hear that, Lee. Let's go to Tracy in Onalaska, who also has something relating to that. Tracy, hi.
How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Good. So just one thing, you know, whether you're colorblind or not, an important thing to remember is you go back to firearm safety course, and they taught you that you need to identify what you're seeing before even raising that gun up and making sure that there's nothing behind it, what you're going to be shooting at, no matter if it's a deer, fox, bear, squirrel, it don't matter. You need to identify what you're attempting to shoot and what's behind it for safety purposes. So as far as not being able to see blaze orange or not, if you're identifying that it's a deer, well, that's number one. If you know it's not a deer, well, then you shouldn't be shooting at it if you're deer hunting.
Yeah.
There's a big difference between a deer and a human.
Yeah. Yeah, that's for sure. Scott, comment?
Well, I understand it completely, and Tracy's absolutely right. But the issue with blaze, and one of the reasons it's required, and you've been in the woods as much as I have, Larry, you get attuned to. You see a glimpse of blaze 200 yards away. You don't see much more than a, you know, 2 square inches of a shirt sleeve or whatever. It's not a matter of whether it's a deer or a human. You know immediately that there's a hunter in that direction, however far away. So there's something, certainly safety, basic safety training and the basic rules of firearm safety trump everything else. But blaze is highly visible, and that's why it's required. And if it's not highly visible, then that presents a challenge, if nothing else. So anyway, so we're making some progress, I guess, on teasing this out here. But you know, initially I brought it up not from the context of safety, although that's certainly important, but from the context of whether colorblindness precluded seeing blood from the standpoint of recovering lost animals, which is also very important to hunting and harvest strategy. So anyway, I think if nothing else, we've learned that it's a more prevalent issue than I think most people thought, and that it is something to consider. So be it.
I want to talk about fish for just a minute, Scott. I want to talk about that photo you shared with me of a fish you caught. Tell us that story and describe what you found for folks.
Larry, you'll have to refresh my memory. I catch so many big fish on a weekly basis. No, I know exactly what you're talking about. About a week and a half ago, I was out fishing with a grandson in a small trout stream here in Dane County, and caught a brook trout, which was what we were after. They're beautiful fish, and you know, I had explained to my grandson that we try not to kill them, so we'd been letting the fish go. And anyway, I caught this particular brook trout, and it was for a small stream, a nice 11-inch fish, very very pretty. But it had a grossly distended stomach. It looked like, for such a small fish, it had swallowed a tennis ball. And I said, what the heck's going on here? Well, as luck would have it, it was hooked deeply and it was injured. So I said, all right, we'll keep this fish. My grandson had never eaten a brook trout. I'll fix it for you for lunch. So I got it home, and I was curious about the stomach. So as I was cleaning it, I slit the stomach open. And so what the heck is that? And I teased this pencil-like thing out of the stomach with the tip of my fillet knife, and I quickly realized it was a snake. It turned out to be a red-bellied snake, and when I stretched it out, it was also 11 inches long, the same length as the trout. So, and there was no sign of digestion, so it was fairly recently consumed. But it didn't end there. The stomach still seemed to be pretty full. So in went the tip of the knife, and oh my gosh, it's another snake of about the same size. And back in, the knife tip went again, and out came snake number three. And back in again, and finally emptied the stomach, was snake number four. So that relatively small 11-inch brook trout had consumed over a fairly short period of time, based on digestion, four red-bellied snakes. And that picture is now circulated to a lot of folks that I know are interested in fish and snakes. And the only speculation we can come up with is that those red-bellied snakes were, this time of year, probably moving toward a hibernaculum for the cold weather, and may have been, which was obviously on the other side of the creek from where the snakes were, and they were crossing the creek. How the fish even got a writhing snake as long as it was down its gullet four times is hard to imagine. But nevertheless, the picture speaks for itself. I had the fish laid out with the four snakes laid out next to it, and they all came out of that snake's stomach. So of the various things I've seen over a long career dealing with wildlife, that was really one of the most startling. So an interesting thing.
It was indeed. Well, let's take another call. Rosie and Blair has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. That snake story was really interesting. My question is about mourning doves. Is there a season for mourning doves, a hunting season?
Yes, mourning doves have been a game bird in Wisconsin for a number of years, not a long period of time. I don't, do you remember about what year that was, Larry? It's got to be close to 20 years ago.
20 years, probably 20 years, yeah.
But there was, when it was first proposed, and you need to realize that mourning doves are hunted in most states in the country, and there are more mourning doves taken or harvested than I think any other game bird. But in some of the northern tier of states, mourning dove hunting was slow to catch on and hasn't, I think, in some places. When it was proposed in Wisconsin, it was very contentious. They're the state bird of peace that was concerned about hunting on telephone lines and around bird feeders. And ultimately, the season was put in place, and it has progressed safely and without incident since it was put in place. There aren't a lot of participants, but there has been some habitat development for doves, primarily in terms of putting in sunflower fields, which attract them and are used as a hunting tool. And for a short, relatively short period of time until the birds move out or have been, you know, shot at enough so they become wary, it provides some excellent shooting opportunity for the people who choose to pursue it. The season opens on September 1st, so it's an early opportunity during nice weather. The birds can be very abundant, and the daily bag limit is 15 apiece, 15 per hunter, so there can be a lot of shooting involved. But again, it has progressed and become ingrained as part of our hunting tradition without, as far as I'm aware, any of the concerns over people shooting birds off telephone wires or at their bird feeders or whatever else. That just would be unacceptable, unsafe activity. So that's about all I can tell you on the matter, Rosie, unless you have a follow-up question.
I do have a follow-up. Do they migrate?
Yes. Well, some, most do. Some will hang around, but they're very sensitive to cold fronts, and it doesn't take much of a cold front. I mean, just down into the low 30s to move some birds on south. And just as an example, I recall I was hunting in Kansas a few years ago, and we were actually hunting prairie chickens, which are very challenging to find. But we had noticed that there were just tons of doves around. And we thought, oh, man, this is great. There's all these doves, and the dove season's open. And we went back to the ranch where we were staying and mentioned it to the ranch owner, and it was also a hunt club. And we said, boy, we saw a lot of mourning doves out around the grain fields. We're going to go out tomorrow morning and have a great hunt. And he said, no, you're not. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, there's a cold front coming through tonight. It's going down to 29 or 30. Doves will be gone. Well, we just couldn't believe that. So we got up early and out we went the next morning, and there was not a dove to be found. They had completely left the area because of that cold front. So, yes, a lot of them do migrate. There's a few that hang around people's feeders and whatnot over the winter, but most of them do head on south.
There you go, Rosie. Thank you for calling. Colette in Eagle River, your turn. Hi, Colette. Maybe we look.
Say, Larry, well, there's a break in the action. I got a report from the grandkids that hunt, and they say they do see orange in their clothing.
Hello, hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello, hello. Hello.
Colette?
Yes, hello.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
Do you have a
question? Okay. I have a question. This morning, I live outside of Eagle River and close to a lake, but everybody's close to a lake in Eagle River. And we, along my edge of my road, which is not close to a lake, and I dug up a nest of turtles, of baby turtles, of painted turtles. And I have four live ones. I don't know what to do with them. Any questions? Any suggestions?
Well, I mean, this is not uncommon. There are a slew of painted turtles around the North Woods up there, and they do tend to nest along cut banks and roadways where there's a gravel shoulder. That's a common nesting area. And typically, the young turtles would emerge from late August into September. And I would guess with the warm weather we're having now, there'll be some more coming out of the ground if the ground is moist enough. Some actually overwinter in the nests and emerge in the spring. But nevertheless, if a nest was uncovered, or if the turtles were emerging and that's how you found them, just take the little turtles to the nearest body of water and plunk them in, and they'll be fine.
Yeah, there you go, Colette. Thank you for calling. Back to you, Scott, for your comments on your grandkids.
Well, yes. They, apparently, a call came in to my better half, and it was, "Hey, Grandma, we see orange with our hunting clothes."
Okay, so they can see orange. Oh man, Sandy in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Hello there. Say, my husband and my dog, and we have a reservation this weekend for camping at Governor Knowles State Forest. And as I'm listening, I'm hearing about young or hunting events or things for this weekend, and I'm just wondering if we need to be concerned with hiking and biking and such.
No, as we talked a little bit about, it's not the participation rate in the youth deer hunt is not, you know, nearly what the general hunting seasons are, and it's often on people's own land in stands that they have set up. So I don't, you know, as someone pointed out, it pays to be prudent and, you know, maybe wear an orange hat if you think hunting is taking place where you're going. But I don't think it should curtail anyone's activities. The youth hunt is not a new thing. It's occurred for years and, you know, without incident. And I guess I'll be out and about, so it's not a concern to me. And I think as long as you have, you're aware of your surroundings, should be fine.
There you go, Sandy.
I certainly wouldn't change my plans, and some state parks may not be open to hunting anyway, youth hunt or not. So I would check with the park when you get there or beforehand and put your mind at ease.
There you go,
Larry,
Sandy. Yeah.
Larry, if we could, toward the end, if we have a couple minutes, I just have a couple kind of news flashes on permit deadlines and a couple other factoids. Maybe we can sneak in if the call slows down.
Let's just go ahead and do that, Scott.
Well, okay, so among the heading of notable wildlife events or things to remember, I won't be back on until early December, and hunters should keep in mind that early in December is the deadline for spring turkey and a few other applications. There's been a lot of coverage recently, and wolves did come up earlier, but the minimum wolf population now in Wisconsin has been estimated. There's a range, but it's somewhere around 1,200, and basically that's an increase over the past couple of years. But there's a new population model being used to determine the population. If people are interested in that, they can go to the DNR website, which has also, like the regulations pamphlet, been dressed up a lot over the last few months. Epizootic hemorrhagic disease, or EHD, has been confirmed in Buffalo County, so some dead deer have been found. That's caused by a virus transmitted by small flies. It's not a threat to humans if you're in that area. The DNR tree seedling sale began on Monday, and if you're interested in some of the tree packets for planting on your property, go online to the DNR website or check with your local forester. Oh, boy, I don't know if anybody saw pictures of it, but a young hunter, an 11-year-old girl, bagged a 700-plus-pound bear a couple of weeks ago. That was, I don't know if you saw a picture of that, Larry. The live weight was over 800 pounds. It looked like a cow. It was huge. So the bear season is in full swing. And lastly, what do they have here? Oh, another nice opportunity. People are interested in phenology, the passing of natural events, and the Aldo Leopold Foundation phenology calendar for the upcoming year, which is very nice and has a lot of information embedded in it, is on sale now through at the Aldo Leopold Foundation at aldoleopold.org. There's a pre-sale until the end of the month. So just a couple things I wanted to get out there for people who might be interested.
Matt in La Crosse wonders, he likes deer hunting and loves eating venison, but he doesn't love butchering deer. Are there any tips or tricks for making the butchering process less of a chore?
Well, I agree it can be a bit of a chore. I do all my own deer and the family's deer, but my dad was a meat cutter, and I more or less have learned by experience what to do. But I would say that the first thing I do is go by the premise that I don't want to freeze or package any bones. So I once the carcass is hanging, the first thing that comes out are the back straps and the tenderloins, and then those are cleaned up and packaged and gone. And then I start with the hindquarters, and basically bone out the big muscle bundles and then clean those up, slice or package them any way you want and get those out of the way. And the same thing with the larger pieces of meat off the front shoulders. At that point, I'm reduced to boning off or essentially cutting off the flanks, rib meat, meat off the shoulder and neck, and then that goes into the grinder sausage pile, and it's either hauled away to a processor who's going to do that, or it goes into whoever's manning the grinder. So it certainly does take a little time, but it's kind of the culmination of the hunt. And personally, I like the knowledge that doing it myself, I know I'm getting it just the way I want it. No hairs, no bone fragments, no bullet fragments, you know, nothing that if I rely on somebody else might be there. Now, having said that, I don't mean to give you the idea that any of the many commercial processes that are available are going to give you back an inferior product. Most of them do a very good job. So the decision a hunter faces, is this a DIY project, or do you just want to pay the bill to have a commercial processor do it and just go pick up your meat in the packages that they put it in as you direct? So that's the fundamental decision. And it's once you've done it a couple of times and know how you want to do it, it's not that big a deal.
Yeah. My dad was a meat cutter as well. So that's the way I learned
it.
I pretty much do it the same way you do it, Scott. Oh, my goodness me. Here we are running a little short on time. I know you wanted to mention that there's been a lot of snake activity.
Yeah, just the last few days with this extreme weather. Well, I shouldn't say extreme, but it's beautiful weather. But it is unusually warm. And there have been some snakes out around the house trying to warm up. The reason I wanted to mention is this time of year, especially, we have a very long, dark asphalt driveway, and the little guys like northern brown snakes or Decay's snakes, the red-bellied snakes and so forth, often come out of the cool vegetation and lie on that asphalt to warm up, and they're very vulnerable to getting squished at that point. So, you know, I caution people as they're entering and exiting driveways or whatnot, or see snakes along the road, they're disinclined to move because they're there to warm up. So try and avoid them if you can. There's also been a lot of amphibian activity the last few days.
Yeah.
My little water garden is just, I don't know where those frogs come from, Larry. I've got a bullfrog, a leopard frog, some green frogs, and they're all just sitting around wondering what to do now with cold weather coming. So I was down feeding them night crawlers this morning, which was kind of entertaining. But this next week or so is going to be an extraordinary opportunity for people to get out. And see our wildlife. So
yeah. Scott, thanks a lot for being with us. You're back on December 2nd. Scott Craven, Emeritus UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. Great to have him with us. Tomorrow at 11, we'll get advice from our home improvement folks about how to get your house ready for winter. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. But hey, in the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store. I'm Larry Mealer.